Whether you're just looking to stay warm during a hunt or need maximum concealment, the clothing you wear can make or break a hunt. At MidwayUSA.com, we understand hunting clothing has come a long way with more meticulously crafted camo patterns, advanced scent control technologies, and weatherproof options to withstand the elements. Hunters have to wait until their favorite season, but shouldn't wait on gear, which is why MidwayUSA offers super fast shipping. When you're ready for your next system, log on to MidwayUSA.com. MidwayUSA brand product designers have one straightforward goal: develop high-quality, technically sound products and deliver them to customers at reasonable prices. If you are immersed in the shooting sports industry and pay close attention to every single detail, you know our products are built right and stand up to everyday use. Who has shooting mats and range bag systems to hunting clothing and just about everything for the outdoors? Log on and shop 24/7 with super fast shipping. MidwayUSA.com.
Well, this sucks.
There's a couple reasons why I wanted to get you on this show again. There's four reasons why I wanted you to get you back on the show. One is you got an extensive background with working with First Nations all over Canada. Yeah. Two, you live in the Yukon, so you're not in BC, but you've been paying a close eye on what's been going on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have great views on both sides of the table. You're able to see what's going on. And four, I love chatting with you. So thanks for coming on again.
Yeah, no, that's good. It's been a busy year for hunting regulations and initiatives and stuff all over Canada and the US. So it's been busy keeping track of it all.
It has, and it's been an emotional roller coaster for a lot. And I think a lot mm-hmm. of people right now, their emotions are running high, and their anger's fueled by emotions. And you know, I kind of think it all stems from not necessarily misinformation, just missing pieces of information.
Yeah. And there are so many layers that with anything that has to do with hunting, because it affects so many different parts of life. We like to sort of talk about hunting as just a biological management issue or just an environmental management issue, right? But as hunters, we know this. We don't just see hunting as just a physical activity. It has to do with all kinds of parts of our life. And managing hunting is the same way. It has so much to do with social and political issues and environmental issues. And think sometimes we don't sort of get the entire, all those layers and figure them out. We don't sort of see the whole sandwich. We just sort of see pieces of the ingredients of it, and we don't get the picture of the whole thing. And it's tough to, we were talking about this the other day, it's tough to have the time to really piece and stitch together all of the different historical issues and current things going on. So I understand for people who are, like you say, they're feeling passionate about this. And sometimes there's misinformation. Sometimes there's just a lack of information. And sometimes there's active disinformation. And it's tough to sort those out.
Yeah, for sure. And exactly. And you know, that's one of the things about, you know, the way the world is now with social media. It's just everything gets turned and twisted, and it gets, you know, governments, whether they it's meaningful or not, they just seem to put a wedge in between people in this, you know, in this specific case that we're talking about First Nations and you know, non-natives, you know, just the lack of communication with resident hunters and the government is just created it's just right now, this whole 7B issue is just a complete mess, mm-hmm. to be honest. So I kind of want to talk about, I kind of want to clarify a few things first. You know, I recently did a post on Instagram, and it stirred up a lot of emotions. I got a lot of comments, some text messages, few phone calls, some emails, not all of them great. The ones that were not great, obviously I deleted them right away, and you know, the emails that weren't great, I just ignored them altogether. Right. Just to clarify, when I was on Friday, I attended the GOABC annual meeting, the Guide Outfitters of British Columbia general meeting. And there was a conversation between Scott Ellis, who's the executive director of the Guide Outfitters Association, and Michael Burwash. He's the associate director for the ministry. of Thin Row. And, you know, there was a lot of conversation. There was a lot of, you know, emotional conversation, a lot of frustration from the guide outfitters directed to Mr. Burwash, and not just Mr. Burwash. He was there on a panel. You know, there was numerous other representatives there of not just the Ministry of Thin Row, but there was, you know, there was people there representing different areas of government. We don't have to get into all that. So anyway, through the conversation, it came out that what the nation is asking of the government is, one, they want the grizzly bear reinstated. Two, they want more controlled burns on the landscape. Three, they want better and more predator control management. I think those are kind of the same thing. I think they're doing a pretty good job currently, the government, of managing wolves. I think that they just want to see more of it. I know there's 12 active sections of land or areas that they're doing predator control. So number four on the list was they wanted moose and caribou hunting shut down for non-residents of the piece. And number five was that they wanted the guide outfitters in the area left out of this. So obviously as soon as I post it, right, you get a lot of angry, emotional hunters. It's tough because I don't see how, you know, we're all taxpayers in this province. I don't see how the province can go along and say, listen, you guys have this postal code so you can access this wildlife resource. You guys don't have that postal code so you can't.
Mm-hmm.
Could you imagine the animosity from all the different regions if that were to happen, from hunters to hunters? Like if you're planning to hunt up north and then they said, no, you can't, but the others can. How do you think the hunters in the south would feel, let's say, if they were the, you know, people from the Peace region were to come down? Like, talk about separating hunters.
Well, and to get back to some of my comments, that's what a lot of people were hinting at, were just like, hey, if we're not going to be allowed up there to hunt in your guys' area, fuck you. You're not allowed to come down and hunt California rams and or bighorns or whatever, right? You're not allowed to come down here.
That's scary.
So it's also just I think you pointed this out in your post, is how would they manage that? How would the BC government actually, I mean, I suppose, you know, applying, you'd have to apply for permits and show residency, or right? But
Well, and only that, this only pertains to moose and caribou. So it's fine if somebody, if say Pete and I want to go up and we want to go hunt deer, go hunt elk, or go hunt black bear, that's fine. But like, it's really like, I just don't see how you can do it, right? Like, I'm a resident hunter. I buy all my tags at the start of the year. I have a moose tag. I'm going up north. I'm going elk hunting, and somebody like a conservation officer pulls me over. He sees I have a moose tag in my pocket. He's going to be like, you're not allowed to hunt moose up here. Right. And then like, how do you kind of like, is he just supposed to take you at your word?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, yeah. You could be hunting the spike fork season in your region, which is the same as my region. We've talked about that before. So all the reason.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm wondering,
first place,
why was the line drawn around residents of that region and non-residents of that region, and not a permit hunt of like an LEH? Or was the thinking that that if you just limited to residents of the region, you could have a manageable number of hunters and also not have to bring in an LEH?
Okay. From my understanding, talking to a couple local guides that operate around, there's three First Nations reserves bands that hold, you know, they have reserve land there in a certain area of the piece. Now, this is not confirmed. This is the First Nations had never said this. This is just a conversation I had with an outfitter. Now, what they are mad at is that out of like resident hunters from down south come up, and there's access roads that are all over, you know, contiguous with the First Nations reserves, right, with their land, and they're going in there, they're setting up big camps, they're making a mess, and they've just had enough of it. Okay. So, I mean, that's where that's coming from.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, so, I can totally see this. I'd like, hey, if you guys are going up there making a big fucking mess, being just assholes, then that's what happens. That's the unfortunate thing about hunting. I mean, we see it all over. You get some idiots out in the backcountry, and they're shooting signs and drinking beers, and they get pegged as hunters doing it, right? And they're just a couple bad apples ruin it for everybody. This where it gets really sticky is like, how, like realistically what could have been asked maybe instead of being like, we just don't want hunters in there, because I you know what, I can see exactly what has probably happened in the past. Now, again, I don't know any of this. This hasn't been confirmed. I'm just, from my point of view, what I could see happening is that maybe, you know, there has been times when outfitters, First Nations up there, they've approached resident hunters and resident hunters have dealt with it in,
yeah,
you know, just
poorly.
Poorly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, and that's what I'm trying to figure out, right? What was the rationale for this, the line between residents and non-residents? And again, like of that region, not of the province, right? And mm-hmm. and that, yeah, I mean, look, like I agree with you. If people are, this is the whole, like, it's the reverse of the whole not in my backyard thing, which is that I will behave differently, for people will behave differently when they're in someone else's backyard than they will in their own backyard. And that's it. Like if people are going into another region of the province and behaving poorly, both socially to other people and, you know, treating the land poorly, I can totally understand the frustration. Absolutely. I mean, there's still the point where that meets, like we were saying before, logistics around management, enforcement, all that kind of stuff. That's so not so neatly designed.
Yeah, well, and now having that on the table, I can see why the First Nations up there would want to have it closed to non-resident hunters. If that's mm-hmm. the case, I could totally get that, right? Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, the provincial government has a responsibility to put resident hunters before guide outfitters. And the guide outfitters right now are getting screwed, perhaps because of the actions of a couple, you know, bad apples. Mm-hmm. You know, this is, again, this is just a conversation we're having. This is not on the record or nothing. This is just a conversation, just speculation. You know, these are possibilities. And again, nobody knows if there was clarity to some of these issues, then maybe it was, but everything is done behind closed doors. So everything, nobody knows. Right.
And yeah, exactly.
And that's the thing, is when I attend a meeting between the GO, you know, that the Guide Outfitters Association of British Columbia had for its members, me being a resident hunter gets into that meeting. And then I hear this, I'm like, well, okay, well, obviously I have to inform my fellow resident hunters, because that's not right. Do you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like the province has an obligation to, number one, have a priority for conservation. Two is First Nations. Three is resident hunters. Four is guide outfitters. So now honoring it, its obligation, if a nation says, hey, our rights to hunt and fish are being affected here to cumulative effect could be too many resident hunters in the area. The province comes back and says, hey, well, according to our priority list for wildlife, we have to honor this and we have to put resident hunters again ahead of guide outfitters. Yeah. Now, unfortunately, guide outfitters are losing the caribou, and they're losing, you know, they're getting 45 moose tags issued over 35 outfits. So that's one or two each, depending. I don't know how that's going to get divvied out, but that's what's happening.
That's a pretty big financial loss for them.
There was a lot of emotions in that room. There was a lot of angry people, there was tears, just because they barely made it through COVID. And most of them that have, okay, well, look at a guide outfitter. Say a guide outfitter buys a territory in 2010. He has a grizzly bear, probably some mm-hmm. black bear in there, moose and caribou. Black bear is not really a huge selling item, I don't see, way up north.
Not a big moneymaker, no.
No. Grizzly bear, huge. Now, if you're told you're going to lose caribou altogether and maybe be given two moose tags, you're done.
Yeah.
You're done.
I would imagine they've got some pretty big overhead and everything too. I mean, all those.
Well, the thing is, they're taking deposits from, when did COVID start? 2020. So they're probably taking deposits from 2020, right? Now they don't have any hunt. They have no other income. They're obviously living off that money. 2021, you know, it's at the last minute, it gets, you know, the borders open up, but how many guys were actually able to make it across, right? So,
and I can imagine some guide outfitter companies would be in a situation where they've got a backlog of hunters and now too few actual licenses for people.
Yeah. Well, that's right.
If they're losing license, they can't even, it's going to take years to actually honor those commitments or refunds, right?
Yeah. So, exactly. Yeah.
But,
exactly.
But I mean, on the other hand, and again, I think you mentioned this as well, so I'm not stealing ideas here, but I could, it's as the as the BC government, knowing that logistically and just sort of ethically in terms of the foundations of the management system, that it's going to be exceedingly difficult to actually, you know, shut down the hunt to non-residents of the region, but keep it open to residents of the region. That's all but impossible. So, you know, like you can see mm-hmm. and understand
exactly.
if you're sort of responsible for running a government, how, okay, well, what's the only thing available then is to just reduce overall the number of hunters in the area.
Exactly. And that's what I said in my post. I said, hey, listen, following that 1, 2, 3, 4 guideline of, you know, mm-hmm. the priority for wildlife, and being unfeasible to just tell a taxpayer you can have access to this resource that as a British Columbian others can have. Just don't see how that is manageable, first of all, and I just don't see how, like, I don't see that happening, right?
Yeah.
That's what I mean, like, I just don't see it's happening. So maybe, you know, and the thing is, nobody knows, but maybe the government has taken all this over into consideration over the last 5 months, 5.5 months, and they said, hey, we have no other alternative here. Either if this is what the First Nations really want, because their rights to hunt and fish are being affected, then we have to honor that, which they do. They totally do, 100%. But in order for them to get that, we have to do this, which is they have to shut down the caribou and they have to limit the moose. Now, if you go back to that 1, 2, 3, 4 rule, yes, the guide outfitters are last on that list. It sucks. It sucks a lot. But the government has an obligation to the resident hunter. So this is mm-hmm. where we're at, right?
Yeah. And, you know, this is where I still kind of come back to this, the bigger context here. So first of all, you know, just as we have been saying, this is an emotional topic and all these things are emotional. This is why we all like hunting, you know, in addition to the food and the exercise and all of that. It's because it's an activity that connects with every single part of our lives. And so it's emotional and it gets heated. So putting that aside for a moment, though, this is where I kind of am interested in, right? And I think just to clarify to people what we're saying, it's absolutely not that we're saying, great idea, where do I sign? It's that we're saying, if you follow the logic, if you follow the steps through, right, then we can understand how this is why we might get to a situation where we are now, right? So if I say to someone, you know, all green foods are poisonous and spinach is green, therefore spinach is poisonous, I'm obviously incorrect in that, but the logic is sound, right? What I've said makes sense. And I think that's what I want to kind of emphasize. That's kind of what we're saying, is if you follow this through and sort of put the pieces together, that's what we can kind of understand how we get to this situation.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. But I mean, where I still kind of come back to the bigger context is the entire reason that the BC government was in this process, which is a decision from a BC Supreme Court decision to address infringements to treaty rights. And my big question is still whether or not, and I mean, I don't have the answer to this, full disclosure, but my question is, right, is still, is the BC government actually making decisions that address the whole foundational part of what that court found? And are these changes to hunting regulations actually going to address the fundamental issue, which was cumulative impacts that resulted in treaty infringements because of resource extraction decisions? And it's easy to see how people are getting really frustrated because there's decisions being made that affect an important part of their life that we then don't really understand exactly how these decisions are really addressing the fundamental issue here.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. It's I don't know, man. It's just so, and that's the thing too. And like, this thing's not that old, right? It kind of just came out when Jesse Zeman let everybody know what was going on, and then it hit social media and then it blew up. And then we're a week and a half into it, and then the dynamic of it kind of changed a little bit here and there, because there's other parties coming out making statements, and then you're having death threats made. And like Pete and I said today, man, you're going to be able to make a fucking movie out of this by the time it's all done.
Mm-hmm. It's crazy. I mean, you look at the beginning of it and the way, you know, just not really knowing much about, I knew that there was a court decision, but I hadn't really followed up on the whole thing at the beginning. So when it kind of came out, and the way that it was written, and correct me, you know, maybe you guys have a different take on it, but when I first read the beginning headlines, when I first heard about it from Jesse Zimmerman, it sounded like it was all directed at industrial encroachment. Mm-hmm. That's kind of where the blame was. And then now it's been shift, you know, and then the answer, you know, as we know, came out as hunting restrictions. Now, I think a lot of stuff could have been just transparency. Mm-hmm. Like if they would have just been open about the whole thing, you know, where it started, what they plan on doing about it. But when you jump from industrial encroachment, which we all know is happening, it's happening everywhere. What are they doing to, you know, be transparent about what their plans are to help with the initial, or what they're telling us is the initial cause anyway, and then going from there, like when you jump from business to all of a sudden resident hunters and restricting moose restrictions, you're just like, where's the rest of the story here? Like this is so incomplete.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, to be clear, I just wanted to clear up what the post said, because like I said earlier, and we kind of touched on it, is that I don't think a lot of people are, they're seeing that post, they're getting emotional as they're reading it, they're not reading the whole thing. So if you're going to read that post, and it's on my Instagram, read it, take a breath, read it again, and see what I actually said, because I've been getting a lot of messages, some text messages, a few phone calls about guys that aren't reading it through. I never once said that the guide out, this is what, you know, this, where we're at is what the guide outfitters wanted. Never said that at all. You know, all I did was I laid out exactly what I heard, and all I did was ask a question. If this is what is being asked by a First Nation, it's their right to ask that. If they feel that their rights to hunt and fish are being affected, it's their right to ask that. Can't argue that. But if that's what's being asked, then maybe this is the only solution. And the government, maybe they're looking out for the resident hunter in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, I kind of want to talk about dealing with this issue now, because like it or not, we're having this conversation, and it's a tricky one. It's, again, a lot of people's emotion, they run rampant, and they get, you know, I don't even know how to bring this conversation up, which is kind of why, yeah, I asked you here, Paul, because I know you're great with these kind of things. You know, the thing is, a lot of people like to do is just ignore it rather than talking about it, which I don't think does any good either. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, there's a lot of people right now, maybe they're angry with First Nations, but, you know, like it or not, that's their right.
Yeah.
That was won in a court of law, and we have to deal with that. And then the thing is, the sooner we learn to deal with it, I think the better we're all gonna be at the end of it, and the faster we're gonna get out of this, and the sooner we're gonna be able to learn to work together. That's what.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think we get into a situation right these days. Everything is so polarized. As soon as you say something, as soon as you say anything, you're immediately walking into, you're being sort of backed into a corner of bipartisanship. Are you conservative or are you liberal, right? And we are increasingly losing that really nuanced middle ground where, in my mind, where the bulk of understanding and meaning and actual sense of everything comes in. There's a reason that people, that, you know, we have this kind of polarization. I mean, that's what sells. That's what sells for the media. That's what sells for politicians. That's what sells for large companies, is to get people dramatically categorized. And the faster that we can, as a society, that we can, you know, lump someone into one category or the other, the easier it is to sell that and to you know, shuffle those complexities off, right? And I think I think when you said, you know, read something, pause, read it again, mm-hmm, then decide if you know enough and you want to say something about it. And that's, I think, yeah, where we get to with this right now is needing to remember that there is a deep historical context here to these issues. And this is not a matter, this is really not a matter of, you know, which side of a political spectrum you're on or partisanship. I think we have to remember to kind of separate out that the fact that, you know, we have in Canada a history of colonialism, a history of interactions and relationships between, you know, initially European governments and then the Canadian government and Canadians and settlers and industry and all of that, that are all tangled up in their relationships with Indigenous peoples across this country. And that's not a political statement. That's not a liberal or conservative or anything else statement. That's sort of reviewing the history of this country. And I think, you know, when you say that, you know, we kind of need to figure out, well, where is the, how do we work together on these things? That is the crux of all of this, right?
Yeah.
That is exactly what these questions are, is figuring out how different groups of people and different rights holders and stakeholders work together on these issues around management and decision-making and conservation. And so that goes far beyond just kind of a happy thing to think that we're going to work together. That's really exactly legally and politically, this is what we're trying to sort out in all of this. What do we have to do? What agreements have been made? What promises have been made and legal agreements signed between the Canadian government and, in this case, First Nations communities that we all have to honor? And we have, as citizens of Canada, we need to remember that governments operate on our behalf, right? So we elect representatives, and those Canadian government does things on our behalf. And so when a treaty, for instance, is signed by the federal government and provincial governments, they're signing that on behalf of all Canadians. And we all, I think these days, to be a little less poetic about it, everyone these days, we really want to beat our chests about rights, right? Like our rights and freedoms. The flip side of rights is responsibilities. There's not a single aspect of my life that I can think about where the flip side of my rights and entitlements is not responsibilities, whether that's my family, my neighborhood, my workplace, my territory or country, right? So I think that's what sort of stands out here is that we have rights and responsibilities, and as Canadians and everyone living in this country, we're all treaty people. We are all part of these treaties. And everyone has rights and responsibilities under those treaties. And so that's, I think, the question, right? Is what are we to do at this point and to sort that out?
Yeah, exactly. I don't, it's going to be really interesting moving forward, especially with this situation and trying to convince people to keep an open mind. And what I wish would happen is I wish people would get a little bit more involved before it's too late. You know what I mean? Like, I know a lot of people say, oh, I feel like I'm just been hit with a truck with all this stuff. Well, actually, dude, this stuff's been going on for a long time. Just chose to not pay attention to it.
And that's why, I mean, that's why, as someone who has lived in Ontario and Newfoundland and Labrador and now the Yukon, I'm trying to pay attention to what's going on in every province and territory in Canada and in the States, because things like this set precedent. Issues like this set precedent, not just for the province or the territory it's in or the state, and not even just for the country and the politics and the regulations and legislation, though that as well, but also just for the bigger context around conservation and hunting, right? And when we look back at the history of hunting and conservation, a lot of the big movements and moments have been these kind of points in time, right? We talk about the big ones, right? We talk about the bison and the passenger pigeon and endangered species things, and all that. And I think that's why it's important. I agree with you. That's why it's important for people to pay attention and to sort of connect the dots about what's going on. None of these things exist in isolation. It's not dramatic to say that what was happening in the late 1800s around bison is connected to what's happening now, you know, and that these things are not just compartmentalized. And it is important for us to pay attention and to get involved. And knowing the bigger context that these things fit into.
Okay, well, sorry, everybody. Bonehead move on my part. I signed in with the wrong account and the meeting zoomed out. So Paul was given a great speech here, but just continuing on what we were talking about is we were talking about racism and just dealing with, you know, these complicated issues now that affect all of us and the emotions running high. So yeah, it's, you know, like I had just said, it's a tricky conversation, but, you know, and I think a lot of guys too, they need help addressing it. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think they just don't, like, they don't know. And a lot of them too, maybe they're easily influenced where they're just like, yeah, man. Like one person posts something and then it just creates a social, like just a bad thread. Do you know what I mean? On anything, like on social media, in conversation, people just build off it instead of one sitting back and being like, okay, here, maybe we should scroll up instead of scrolling down here. Let's dive into this a little bit more and you know, see if we can come up with a solution or see what's the root of the problem here? You know, and it's kind of like at what we were talking about at the beginning there, you know, take a moment, take a breath, read the post, read it again. If you're still a little confused, which we all are, you know, reach out or, you know, Google something. There's lots of information out there. And I mean, unfortunately, it's up to all of us to process what we take as good information and bad. And I know I get it. Sorting out through some of that shit is, it's not the easiest.
Yeah. And I mean, find people who aren't telling you stuff you already think you know. You know, mm-hmm. Reaching out to your buddy who gets you more jacked up and doesn't challenge anything, doesn't sort of push and tell you something you don't already think, is not probably helping all the time, right? And I think that I think was what we were kind of talking about before we got booted out there, is just sort of remembering, like, trying to understand the bigger context and the historical context of all of this stuff. And, you know, it doesn't just start and end with this one particular issue and this one case right here. These fit into bigger conversations, historical conversations, and they're going to change and affect hunting and conservation and relationships between, you know, settler Canadians and indigenous people in this country into the future. So these are long processes. These aren't things that get summarized in and sort of dealt with in whatever Twitter's at right now, 280 characters or less, right? Like these are complicated issues, and trying to simplify them is not doing a service to us or to hunting and conservation at all. And I think that's what, you know, for me, I think it's sort of, we need to become very comfortable with the complexity of these things and sort of question and resist anything that presents them, and anyone, whether that's a person or a political party or a media outlet or whatever, that presents these things as simple and easily compartmentalized, because they're not, you know.
No, exactly. And I think a lot of people feel threatened, and I think their natural reaction is to, like, fight. Do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, the fact is, Indigenous reconciliation isn't going away. It's not done. Like it or not, this is something we're all going to have to learn to live with and deal with. Not that it's a bad thing. It's just something that's happening. And, you know, back to what I said earlier, I think that if people took it upon themselves to be a little bit more engaged with these conversations that are happening every day. And you know what, if they don't agree with something, then deal with it in a positive way, but deal with it then. Don't let it sit and build mm-hmm. up, and don't wait till it's too late. It's like how I think a lot of people are feeling right now with, you know, with potentially losing a hunt that, you know, maybe some people have gone up there for four generations. Maybe yeah. some people have gone up there with their great grandfathers, and they hold it near and dear to them. And I get that. I get that a lot. I have places, you know, that I've only hunted. My family hasn't hunted them. I mean, we moved down here from the north. We hunted in a lot of areas up there, and I'm sure other people up there feel the same way. But down here, I have places that I hold very near and dear to me. And if you took them away, I tell you, I'd be very, very mm-hmm. upset, because I spend a lot of my time in there. My kids and I, we spend a lot of time in there, and that's, to us, that's part of our livelihood.
Right? Yeah. Yep.
Well, and I think a lot, the one thing that I'm hoping for is, regardless of the decision that's made at the end, the one thing I don't want is for this just to be rushed out, slapped together, and here's what we're going to do. I'd rather it be all parties involved. Everybody put their cards on the table, you know, get the best possible result for as many people as possible. I'm sure there's always going to be people that, you know, we're not going to be able to keep everybody happy, mm-hmm. but have a well thought out process. Everybody say what they want, say how it affects them. If, you know, like the plan A, B, C, D, and then let's try to pick all those together, and let's, you know, just a giant round table, but leave the politics out of it as much as possible and try to come up with a plan that suits as many people as possible. If you just mm-hmm. throw it together, that's what I'm worried about. Something, you know, you're going to make, like we talked about a little earlier, you're going to make a decision and you're like, okay, that doesn't sound so bad. But when you actually start asking people, the ramifications are actually huge for some small decisions or thoughts that nobody brought up. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm worried about
Well, you know, the thing, Pete, I think that this is this whole thing, like this whole being rushed into it. I don't think anyone's being rushed into it. This, from my understanding, this all started in like 2016. Like this goes way back, right? And then it just in October, the court said, hey, told the province, you have 6 months to deal with this. Now, I think this is a reflection of how things work inside our government. I think things take too long. I think there's too many people that need to sign off or need to approve it, things that don't have invested interest in that particular subject. Like the issue of wildlife management shouldn't have to go through 50 freaking people in government. It should, this issue should be brought to a round table, like you said, where you have a representative, say, the First Nations. Maybe that's a multiple seat thing. Maybe it's a whole bunch of seats. I don't know. You need a resident from resident hunters there, the guide outfitters there, forestry, fish, and whoever else. Maybe, you know, the anti-hunters have a seat at the table, right? Everybody with invested interest, every resident deserves to have a voice. And I think that's the problem. I think a lot of resident hunters feel like they're not being represented. They're not being heard, and they're just being left out. And this is what creates this frustration, I think.
Yeah. And I think, like, you know, that's as a resident hunter, as someone not in BC, but as a licensed hunter, as in non-Indigenous hunter in Canada, you know, we are not, like, I think the message is we absolutely cannot descend into lobbing sort of racist fastballs all over the place. You know, we need to realize the context that all this is in, and the political context and the social context, and that, yes, we are one voice and one stakeholder here. But, you know, we have a situation in this country where rights are not all the same across all groups. And that's for important reasons. And people may not agree with those reasons, but there is a point where, you know, everyone has an opinion about this, but not necessarily grounded in the same set of knowledge and perspectives on it, right? So the fact of it is that not everyone's right to hunt is exactly the same. And that is for important reasons. And so when we get into sort of bringing perspectives to the table, we are doing active harm to hunting itself in society and to our kind of place in at that table, that proverbial table you guys are talking about. As licensed hunters, if we start firing off racist social media posts, anti-Indigenous comments all over the place, we're actively harming hunting and our place and our voice in that, right? And we need to get to a place where we can, you know, express what this hunting in this region might mean to us and our families. And we need to be able to express a political opinion about the decisions that come out of this. And we need to express uncertainty and maybe express that we don't know the whole story on certain things. And all of those things can be true. You know, we don't minimize, and I hear this sometimes in various arguments and debates and in the hunting community as well, that the second we say that we don't know something or that we're unsure, it's sort of this idea that we are opening ourselves up to weakness or vulnerability. And I just don't think that's true. I just refuse to accept that multiple things can be true. We can feel passionate about the ability to continue hunting and doing things that we love. And we can also understand that the perspective and the position that, like, making anti-Indigenous and racist comments anywhere is just wrong. That's not a political opinion. That's something that we all need to kind of understand, and that it's harming hunting the more we see that and hear that from people.
Exactly. If we want, okay, now as resident hunters, if we want to be heard, if we want to have a voice, if we want to be brought into these negotiations, if we want to be part of this active conversation, racism, you know, anything to do with racism, death threats, any threats of any kind, that, you know what I mean? We're going to be left out hanging high and dry indefinitely. That's not the way to get your foot in the door. Absolutely not.
No, exactly. And as I say, I think whatever perspective we look at this from, if we want to look at this from the position as, you know, the kind of as sort of proud Canadians or, you know, proud hunters, we have to kind of go back and look and realize that that engaging thoughtfully in this process of reconciliation affects all Canadians, and it's in the Constitution. So the risk of sounding a bit dramatic, you know, to be against the idea of reconciliation or against thinking a thought, you know, critically and earnestly about our obligations in this country to treaties is not doing justice. It's not standing up for the Constitution. It's not standing up for our democracy or the history of hunting and the history of what hunting and conservation means in this country. And you know, the history of hunting and conservation in Canada and in North America grew out of this sort of movement towards that democracy. And it has difficult past and difficult histories with regards to relationships with Indigenous communities.
It does, man. The history of hunting, a lot of it's dark. You know what I mean? A lot of it's not pretty. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like a lot of it's ugly.
Yeah.
There's a lot of ugliness in it. But I mean, yeah, it to some of us, and I mean, to a lot of us, it's part of our heritage. Now, in saying that it's part of our heritage, and that, you know, I started hunting with my dad when I was 8 years old, and so on and so on, it doesn't mean that somebody who's 37 years old, an adult onset hunter getting into hunting, can't enjoy the same things mm-hmm. that I love to do. He absolutely can. But hunting has evolved, like not mm-hmm. hunting itself, but you know what I mean? Hunting as an entity has evolved.
Yeah.
It's not how it was before. It's never going to be like that. We have to learn to accept the fact that the Indigenous people have rights to hunting and fishing. We have to accept those rights. We do have rights as our own, you know, as resident tag holders. If we go out and buy a hunting license, we have rights as well.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, it's not that it's changed. I think it's still changing.
I mean?
I think it's going to be a revolving door of changes. And, you know, there's going to be issues coming up again where something is going to be threatened to be taken away from the resident mm-hmm. hunter. And, you know, maybe on the other side of the table, maybe it's going to be threatened to taken away from the First Nations as well, because of environmental changes, right? Yeah. Maybe there's not going to be a sustainable harvest for moose. Right, then everybody's going to suffer. But if we're all sitting in a room, pointing fingers, butting heads, swearing at each other, that's never going to help in the end. It's not going to help the resource.
No, right? And I think like people need to remember too that any community you go to anywhere that's a heterogeneous group. It's a group of people that have all kinds of different opinions. Right? No community of people anywhere shares the exact same opinion, same perspective. And believes 100% in every decision made by their government. I mean, that's something that I think is especially over the last few years, we that's something at least the very least we all have in common, is that we don't all agree with every decision made by every government in this country and on this continent. And we need to also more broadly recognize that there's no sort of pan-Indigenous voice or perspective. There's no one thing that all Indigenous communities and even all people within one Indigenous community think. And, you know, having worked with, like you say, I've worked with First Nations and Inuit and across Canada, and like every community everywhere, there are many perspectives and many experiences and voices within those communities and between those communities. And so, you know, to kind of, I think, again, the message there to non-Indigenous and to resident and licensed hunters is to we really need to resist that and resist that perspective that we understand every single person's perspective on this mm-hmm. another community and another group of people somewhere. And because, like you say, when that belief that one group of people is all the same butts up against heated, emotionally charged issues, we get that ugliness that we're talking about, and it's not going to help, and it is going to do active harm. And that's, I think, we'll kind of bring it full circle where we started on this, is why I'm paying attention to this issue. Why I'm, you know, not being a BC resident, you know, I've done graduate work in Indigenous politics and in legal decisions around that affect Indigenous rights and jurisdiction and things like that. And I'm a hunter and I've worked in environmental research and management. And there's all of these things that come together for me. And I think that that's really my big message in this is, this is complicated and this is not going to be isolated to this one case and this one instance of this one region of one province. This is going to interact, it's going to come back up, and we need to take the time to understand it and to really get comfortable with all the different complexities of it, of this issue, the legal ones and the political ones and the environmental issues and the interpersonal aspects of it. And the easy way out is the cheap, lazy and the easy way out is to, like I say, kind of lob these racist balls across the room. And it's just, it's not the one that's going to advance our hunting interests, our social or political interests, or just our interests as human beings.
Like I said, it's not going to get us where we want to be. And as resident hunters, I think I speak for a lot of resident hunters that we want to be heard. We want to make sure that our voice is heard and we want to make sure that our rights are being protected because we just can't be shut out completely. Mm-hmm. That to me, that's unacceptable. If they were to say resident hunters can't hunt anymore, I'd be like, no,
yeah.
Like that's not going to happen. I'm going to tell you straight now, that is not going to happen.
Yeah. And, now, that's,
and I know a lot of guys up there are feeling the same thing. Like somebody who's lived up in that region for 60 years, he's had to shoot a moose for the last 50 years. And you go tell, or a caribou, and you go tell him, no, you didn't get an LEH draw this year. You mm-hmm. can't go hunt moose. You think he's not going to go shoot a moose and to feed his family?
Especially as we've been pointing out, you know, for the last couple of weeks, this has been going on the last few weeks, really, that this is the British Columbia government has made these decisions in the absence of conservation concerns, right? Moose populations are not going down. The hunt is well managed. And so, we've been hearing, this is one of the things that has been inspiring about this particular case to me, as troublesome as it is we're seeing the BC Wildlife Federation, the Wild Chief Society of BC, Wilderness Locals, you guys at Focus, we're seeing all of these big organizations, Howl for Wildlife, Blood Origins, and Hunt to Eat, making the point that there is a difference between going after the groups in this case and that have recognized and affirmed rights, and there's between that and the decisions made by the British Columbia government, and that all of the organizations I've seen speaking out about this so far, they've done a commendable job, including you, of making the point that we need to be sort of going after and targeting and addressing the BC government in this case. They're the ones that are on the hook for irresponsible resource extraction, for treaty violations, for poor decisions about hunting management, or at least as you guys have said, communication about the reasons for those decisions and a lack of transparency. And that's the point, right?
I think, yeah, like from, you know, it goes back to maybe, like I said earlier, maybe they are looking out for our best interest in this case. But the thing is, this should have been addressed. They did a shitty job, and this should have been addressed a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
This should have been addressed to resident hunters a long, long time ago when it first got addressed to them.
And I don't think that anyone has been dramatic in this by saying that, you know, that the government is falling back on this kind of divide and conquer approach. They're lobbying these decisions out there without communication, explanation. And now we're seeing different groups of people at each other's throats. And
well, exactly. That's exactly what they did. They threw it out to proposal. You know what I mean? And they put it out 2 weeks before it ended.
Mm-hmm.
And with no explanation of why this is happening. There's no background history on it. And like, again, you know, myself included, could have been paying attention a little more. But I mean, like, there's so much stuff. How do you keep track of it all? Do you know what I mean? And live mm-hmm. your life and do all that. Like, I get it. But the government should have been a little bit more clear on exactly what's going on. Now, I get the fact that they can't actively comment on current negotiations or stuff that are in a court case battle. I get it. But a little transparency would go a long way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. And like, as much as we're saying it's their responsibility to communicate to make and then communicate about wildlife management decisions, the provincial, territorial, and federal governments in this country also have a responsibility to facilitate processes like reconciliation. So yes, I understand that they can't disclose the inner workings of negotiations and legal discussions, right? But they do have a responsibility to both Indigenous and non-Indigenous British Columbians and Canadians to prevent what we're seeing starting to happen here, and which is, you know, anger and animosity towards groups. Our governments have a responsibility to step in and to make sure that they're communicating things and facilitating discussions in a way that is not allowing for and is not creating these kinds of disagreements and anger and issues and stuff. And at the very least, in that they failed.
Yes. There's so many different roads and there's so many different ways looking back on it now, how it could have went. I mean, obviously hindsight's 2020, but
yeah.
And it just, and that's the thing. And then guys get hit with stuff, that information that they're hearing for the first time, and they get pissed off.
Yeah. And I wanted, like, definitely give you credit there. You know, you made the point a couple times, and I made it in a piece that I wrote about this as well. If honoring treaty obligations to First Nations, if one of the issues in or needs in that is to adjust hunting regulations so that we're ensuring as resident and licensed hunters that we are upholding treaty obligations, we need to consider that, and we need to understand that. And again, this is not a partisan political issue. This is, in that case, this is a matter of legal and moral obligations that we have, commitments that our country has made. And I think that's important, the point that you made, that you said there, you know. And again, I kind of come back to that can exist at the same time as the disappointment and frustration and the expression of, like, the impacts of decisions like that. But if we need to make decisions, you know, if current hunting regulations are a factor in treaty issues, then we need to go to the table and we need to consider that. And we need to openly think about that. And I think that that's where this has come to me, is it has not been clear to me that adjusting the hunting regulations is going to address identified treaty issues and violations. And if it is, then hey, that changes the conversation to me.
That's the situation. Okay, like on Friday afternoon, before I went to that meeting, that was the situation. That was my understanding, is mm-hmm. that shutting down, if you were to shut down moose and caribou hunting, or shut down caribou hunting, put in an LEA straw, that's still not gonna meet what is being asked of the government, right? It's not going to meet the criteria of what is being asked of the government. But then why does this take so fucking long? Why do it 2 weeks before it's going back to court right away? Why wait so long?
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Like in October, well, come on, they knew about it way before October, right? It's just in October, the court said, hey, you have 6 months to make it, come up with a solution that's going to meet the requests of the nations. And if that is not met, we're going to come up with one for you. Now, I don't understand how that all works in front of a court. Now, the province has an obligation. They got a number one support. They got it for wildlife. It's conservation, First Nations, resident hunters. Now, does the court have to abide by that? Or can the court, if it goes in front of a court, can a judge just say, okay, well, we're going to let resident hunters of the peace hunt here. We're going to let guide outfitters operate this, and resident hunters, the rest of the resident hunters of the province, you're out. These are questions that people have, right? I'm not the only one who has this question as a resident hunter. There's tons of guys, but nobody, like, this is stuff that the provincial government should have presented with, and even if they listed that into proposal, it doesn't have to go into that deal, but just say, hey, this is what roughly we need to accomplish. These are our options. Any feedback on the best option, we'd love to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't. And then resident hunters get slapped in the face. And unfortunately, when a First Nations right to hunt and fish gets put, when a First Nations right to hunt and fish, man, like, a lot of people feel that there's food on the table and it's being given to one side of the table and the rest of the people are just going to be hungry.
Yeah,
that's tough.
Yeah, it's super tough. And I think, like, for myself, I have way more questions now than I did Friday morning.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, as a Friday, I just figured it was a simple, oh, here we go again. It's government's taking the side of industry here, and we're just
taking the shit on the outside. But another thing you hear is that Katrine Conroy, our minister, she's got family ties to logging. So then you start hearing this stuff, and you're like, oh Jesus, I know exactly what's going on, right? They want to keep logging in an area where the nations had said no, we don't want logging in here, and because we want to have a better moose than caribou harvest, and the resident hunters are out just so they can keep logging.
Yeah,
like there's so many things that float around, and you're like, Jesus, like again. And I mean, I'm guilty of it just as much as the next guy. You read it, and you're like, right away, your brain starts putting these little pieces of the puzzle together that maybe they're not there. Maybe that's not even from the right fucking puzzle.
Yeah.
But you're putting it there because it connects the dots the easiest for you when you're looking at it quickly.
Yes. Yes, it does. And then it goes back to what Paul touched on earlier, and what we had all said, you know, take a breath, read it again.
Yeah. And engage in the whole picture, in the whole context, right? Don't sort of cherry pick the things that are going to confirm and the confirmation bias piece of things. Like, don't just kind of cherry pick the things that are going to confirm. There is a bigger context to all of this, you know, and we need to understand it all.
It's just not going to go like this is, unfortunately, this isn't the last of it. Do you know what I mean? I mean, not that there's going to be more issues like this in the near future.
Yes.
I feel that sheep are going to be subject to a conversation coming up probably sooner than later. Having said that, we got to stay focused on the objective, whether we like it or not. As resident hunters, First Nations have priority over us.
Mm-hmm.
Conservation is number one, First Nations two, resident hunters, and then the outfitters.
You know, with all this stuff coming up, a lot of the bottom line is it doesn't even matter which part you look at, is the mismanagement from the government, business-wise, First Nations-wise, wildlife-wise. They've mismanaged everything. And like you said earlier, Kevin, they've taken so long. And that's why we're here, on their decisions, on their poor decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And what are your thoughts, both of you, on in BC in particular, on having another body, another association, something that is in charge of the wildlife? That's their goal, is the wildlife section, to take the politics out of it. It's educate hunters, non-hunters, anti-hunters on their goals, like to bring wildlife back. And, you know, once you take the politics out, and then when you have these round tables, you know, you've got your different government bodies that are coming in for, you know, logging, guide outfitters, resident hunters, you know, every place is different. But when the wildlife has their own spokesperson or group, and that's all they focus on, what do you guys think of that? Do you think that would help some of the situation out, instead of having things mixed all the time?
You know, Pete, I think that, like, I love that idea. And I think that's easy to say. But I think once you get into politics, it completely changes.
That's fair enough.
That's what I think. I think soon as you get into that world, I think it's a lot different. Like, I'm not in politics. Paul, I don't know if you have any background in it, but I think once you're engaged in that, we're talking about somebody who's elected or somebody who's given that seat.
Yeah.
It's not going to be me or you sitting at that table.
We wouldn't be allowed. I'd be throwing tables.
But
that would last about a day.
Yeah. So, and that's the thing. And then apparently there's a whole big, reworking being done. But what that looks like, I don't know. And like, is it going to do any good? I don't know. But I think the biggest thing is just transparency, openness, and communication are going to be the biggest tools that the government can give us in dealing with issues moving forward. That's what I think.
Throw education in there too. I think that's what a lot of people, I'm not talking school education, I'm talking the facts, everything, like from start to beginning, like this is why we're doing it. Even simple things like prescribed burns, why we're doing them, what they benefit, you know, predator control, whatever you want. Education on everything, not just the bare minimum, so that groups can, well, like you guys are saying, cherry pick whatever certain fundamentals they want out of each thing, but be like, no, this is why we're doing it. Start to
Yeah. I mean, and it gets into economic, right? It's like second growth. Why can they not log second growth? The roads are already there. Government doesn't get any fees from roads that are already there. They only get it from new roads being built, right?
So yeah.
That's the thing, is the government's looking at a budget that they have to meet. They've got promises they have to meet. People are looking at them to meet budgets. They got lots of different, that's why I think it's easy to sit here and say we need this, but like once you get involved, then all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, like we got like right now in Vancouver, or not just in Vancouver, all over, like what's a hot topic? Gasoline prices, right? Affordable housing. These are issues that politicians, people in office are dealing with every day. And so when it comes to a table, they're like, well, fuck, what? Some guys don't get to go hunt moose, go hunt them in a different area. What the fuck do I care? Right.
Yeah.
There's a lot of shit going on. And I get the fact that a lot of people have a lot of food, like they got a lot on their plate, but I also know I know people who work in government, and I also know their time can be managed better than it is being managed. Like they can do more with their day. And that's, I'm not saying all of them. I'm just saying that there's definitely, yeah, it's just, it could be done a lot better, and it's being done. Yeah. Anyway,
yeah.
You guys got anything to add before I wrap this up?
Oh man.
That's a big one. Yeah. I mean, I'm eagerly watching, you know, from, and I know that there are others in the Yukon watching as well. I've been chatting with people thinking, you know, as we kind of watch this stuff unfold in different areas around the continent. And I think it's gonna be important for everyone to kind of, I mean, I'm sound like a broken record, but kind of just really pay attention to what's going on around and not see these things as compartmentalized, not see something as, well, as only a hunting issue and that now it's my issue, or only another kind of issue. And now therefore it's not my issue, because we're seeing these things come together, and we're seeing as we're seeing different issues that we might think are discrete and separate, they do affect each other. And it takes reflection, and it takes, you know, a kind of patient engagement with it to understand it all. So, you know, I think we're going to look back on these and as some of these issues as turning points in our understanding of hunting and conservation. So,
yeah. And hopefully they are, they're a wake up call to people to start getting engaged and, you know, and just to get engaged and start paying attention and be part of stuff that's going on. Don't just wait for the regs to come out and open up the page to your region and then be like, holy shit, they shut down the moose hunt.
Yeah.
Or like, holy shit, we could only hunt moose for 3 days.
Yeah.
You know,
educate yourself on the whole story before you start commenting, because you're going to end up looking like a fool if you actually don't know what you're talking about, because you've only read a few comments here and a few comments there. And you think, well, you've got the whole story. You know what?
And it's funny too, you're like, not just the post I wrote, but you read other posts and you start reading some of the comments and you're like, dude, did you read any of that fucking post that the guy put down? Yeah. Like, what are you talking about, man?
Yeah.
That has nothing to do with what was said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know what else is really interesting is that how they're going to deal with the issue. Say this does go through, the harmonizing of regions 6 and 7 regarding moose and caribou. Because from my understanding, if this gets shut down in region 7, it gets shut down. If that harmonization did go through, which I don't think anybody probably paid too much attention to it back in January. I think people just kind of looked at it and been like, I don't know what the heck you're talking about, right? It's going to be really interesting moving forward where that plays into all this, because even up in your area, Paul, because, you know, if there's, say, that harmonization did go through for moose and caribou, that means no more caribou hunting in British Columbia. And it also means moose on LEH in all of British Columbia, north of Quesnel, basically.
Yeah.
Now, what kind of impact is that going to have on the wildlife as a resource in your neck, like in the Yukon?
Totally. Oh yeah.
Regarding guide outfitters, right? Because that the demand is still there, and I think that with the declining numbers in caribou, I think the demand is more there ever. Where guys are like, man, I've caribou is a bucket list hunt of mine. I got to get in there now and do it right. So it's gonna be really interesting. Like I said,
no, that's the thing. When wildlife don't operate by provincial territorial boundaries.
No, exactly.
So, yeah,
exactly. And they're not paying attention to what's going on.
No, exactly.
Right? Like, what I mean, like the caribou down here could be like, oh shit, this is way better. I'm not getting shot at, but the guys, their buddies north are going to be like, oh, that's Christ, right, man, what's going on here?
Yeah. Yeah. So, and you know, one other thing that I'll kind of leave everyone with, and I can send this to you or we can post this. This goes back a couple years, but it's still ongoing. You know, the Kaska Dene, who are indigenous group that's in Northwest Territories, Yukon and British Columbia, are working on establishing an indigenous protected and conserved area in Northern British Columbia right now. They've been working on it for a couple of years that, you know, and so this one, you know, particular article, and there's someone, a Kaska Dene woman named Jillian Stavely, who's been really involved in this, and to this area, the Dene Kusan area, Northern BC, you know, this stands to have huge benefits for biodiversity and for anyone who cares about healthy wildlife and healthy areas. And Jillian has said, you know, the hunting community, the licensed hunting community, has been some of the biggest supporters and allies for this area that they're working on creating, because people recognize, the Kaska Dene and hunting community recognize, that this benefits everyone. This benefits wildlife. It benefits licensed hunters, indigenous rights, indigenous hunters. And so there are these pockets here where we're seeing incredibly inspiring and positive alliances and support between indigenous communities who are working on things and non-indigenous hunting communities. So I also encourage people to find those and realize that the narrative is different. It's not always what we're seeing in this case. So
awesome. And I think that's really important, right? Because like we touched on earlier, that's what we need, right?
Yeah.
We need that. Yeah. Wildlife have to come first, right? Mm-hmm. Above all our needs. Now, obviously, political pressure takes priority. Like this is political pressure, right? The grizzly bear hunt was political pressure. There was no science that supported or said that this needed to be shut down. It was just, it's political pressure. But it doesn't go the other way. Well, I shouldn't say that actually, because there is areas that I think that, you know, should be looked at, especially down here regarding the sheep, maybe some areas where, Peter, what were we talking about earlier? The numbers get below.
Oh, the province has set standards. So they've got their own policy that's written, and I can't remember the exact number. I'll say 75 animals for a herd. Don't quote me on that. We'll just use that as a number. And their policy is if a specific herd, goes below that number, the hunt will be shut down, like LEH, everything, until the numbers recover, and then it can go back on LEH. They've already got one hunt. I can't remember which herd it is. And some of the anger that's going on there is the herd is actually below that number and has been for a few years, and they're still running an LEH for it. So they're going against their own policy there. And at the same time, they're looking at putting LEH, again, just no scientific evidence for another herd down in that area, southeastern BC here. And they've brought in biologists on the side. Jesse Zeman knows all about this. We've been chatting about it. And even the biologists, world famous, are saying, no, everything's fine. Like, there's no reason to go on LEH. We've got to figure out what else is going on for, you know, the herd going down in numbers and stuff, but it doesn't need to go on LEH. But they're pushing it as hard as they can to go LEH. It's just like, well, you're going against biologists, you know, using their science, saying, no, don't do this. And then on the other hand, you're going against your policy, you know, keeping a herd that's below its numbers in LEH. So it's just like, you guys need to get your story straight and stick to it. But it's just, it's crazy, the mismanagement.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. And again, that's, you know, that was my point earlier, is that, you know, our fingers, they still got to stay pointed at the government, because there's a lot of areas where they're not doing a good job, and that they need to be doing it better, and they need to be held accountable too when they're not doing a good job. So, but I think we got to wrap this up. Past my bedtime. So, Paul, thanks again for coming on, bud.
Thanks a lot, guys. It's always good to chat with you. And I think, you know, you're doing a great job with this. This is a tricky one, and
it's a tough conversation. It's hard to even talk about, but I think you just got to force yourself to talk about it and just, you know, and be engaged and just be positive, and hopefully things are going to look better moving forward rather than going in the opposite direction.
Exactly. And just keep nudging the conversation along a little bit at a time, and not being afraid. Like, I think this is something that you've shown such a great leadership on in this particular case, is being willing to, change course when new information comes out. That's what science is. We talk all the time as hunters, science-based management, science-informed management. Science means adjusting our position as we learn new things and being proud of that and being okay with that, you know? And I think that's what, I think what you're showing in this, and what I think we need to see all hunters kind of embrace is these difficult decisions and ways forward and adjusting as we learn new things. So I think you're doing a good job. So thanks a lot for hosting the conversation and having it in this space and in the hunting community. We need it to happen. We need people to listen and to be part of this.
Yeah. Okay, guys. Till the next time, Pete. We'll catch up soon. Okay, guys.
Have a good night. Take care, guys.
Okay, I want to thank everyone again for tuning in to another episode of the Focus Hunting Podcast, which is coming at you as part of the Waypoint Outdoors Collective. This episode of the Focus Hunting Podcast is brought to you by Vortex Optics, the best in optics, period. Backroads Maps. Never get lost with Backroads Maps. And AKU Boots. You owe it to your feet. Quick shout out to Howl for Wildlife. If you guys are not familiar with Howl for Wildlife, make sure you head on over to howlforwildlife.org. Become a member. It doesn't cost you anything. They got tons of great stuff going on, and we're going to be working with them getting some Canadian issues put on their platform. Thanks again, everybody.
Listening to the Waypoint Podcast Network, brought to you in part by HuntStand, the number one hunting and land management app.
One of the most legendary shows in the outdoors is on Waypoint TV. Don't miss Primo's Truth About Hunting, Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.